Good evening, everyone. Our teacher, Don Brown, isn't here yet, but I'm sure he's on his way. So I'll go ahead and get us started with a few announcements. So welcome back from our summer break of all of July. And so now we're starting on the second half of this series of Discovering Buddhism. It's a two-year course, and I think we're about almost at the beginning of the second year. But you can start at any module. So those of you who are here for the first time, I'm glad you're here for the first time for this module, because then you'll be able to get it all. But you just pick it up where we are and go with us. I want to make sure everyone picked up a copy of the handout that's on the table back there. I'm going to go through it very quickly. There's going to be four classes. This is a short module, so four classes. And then on August 31st will be our practice day, so that will also be a Monday. And if you miss class, you can catch up by either listening to an audio recording of it or watch it streaming if you're just out of town or can't get to the center. In order to access the audio and the streaming, you need to be a member of Kadampa Center. And so those of you who are not members but would like to be members, Kim Lillig is our membership chair. She's not here, but she said she would be here tonight to sign people up, to explain membership and sign people up in case you want to do that. If you'd like to think about it, the second Sunday of every month, she leads an orientation, a new member sign up, so you can do it then. Apparently, we do also have videos available on YouTube, but it takes a bit of searching to get to those videos of the classes. So the second page of your handout shows the... The required shows the Online Learning Center website from the FPMT, the Foundation for the Preservation of the Mahayana Tradition, an organization of which we are a member. If you can, you don't have to be a member of Kadampa Center to access that, but you do need to create a user ID and password. It's very easy to do. All the instructions are on this page, and that's where you will find the most of the required readings for this class. In addition to the readings shown there, and there are also some nice teachings available on there. In addition to those readings, there are two books, Liberation in the Palm of Your Hand. We use that for every module, so that's nice to have, even though you're not going to, believe me, you don't want to read the whole thing for this class. It's about that thick. But some pages in that will be applicable to this class. And also in our bookstore, there is this small booklet called Refuge in the Three Jewels, and that's also required reading for this class. So that's available here in our bookstore. Let's see what else. The last page in your handout is a completion card for this module, and we really strongly encourage people to try to complete this in terms of the meditations and practices and doing all the reading. It really helps you grasp the material and understand it more than just coming to class and listening to the teacher. This is really where the work takes place. And if you complete these completion cards for each module, then you can hang on to all those, send them to FPMT, and you can get a diploma for all of Discovering Buddhism. But, we encourage you to do this if you have the time and the motivation. I think that's it for my announcements. Anybody have any questions, anything I may not have covered for you? If not, I'll be around after class. We usually have a discussion. It's totally voluntary. You don't have to do it, But if you'd like to just talk about some of the things we went over in class, you're welcome to stay. We do it out in the lobby area. There's a large conference table out there. And Susie, will you be out there? Susie back there will be out there. And here's Don. Welcome. I was just covering the logistical stuff. Yeah. We were just going over this handout, so there's your copy of it. And also, if a few of you could stick around afterwards, we need to restore the normal seating order to the Gompa when we're done, which means we have rows up here and not a little semicircle. So if a few of you could stick around and help do that, that would be great.
Hello? Yeah, so maybe a good time to... The password? What's that? That didn't work. Be ridiculous. Okay. So it's not going to work. It's not that big a deal. Oh, wait a minute. It booted up. All right. So this class is about and it didn't come at the beginning. It's called the Refuge in the Three Jewels. And it's about taking refuge in. Well, let's first of all talk about the word refuge. What does that word mean to people when you hear the word refuge?
Safety.
Pardon?
Safety.
Okay. Anybody else? Raise your hand because this is being recorded, so we can get your voice on air. Anything else? Yeah.
I think of refugees.
Refugees, okay. Anybody else?
I think of a peaceful place.
Anybody else?
I think of a wildlife refuge.
Okay.
We are wildlife.
Is it? Doesn't the word refuge have something to do with garbage, too, sometimes? Yeah.
Protection,
okay. I think we got a good start. So this class goes to the end of the month on Monday nights. I think we have at least four. Maybe five.
Four and one practice.
Yeah, and one practice. So we'll do the practice the last night. I've taught this class, by the way, I've taught it before. I'm not brand new off the boat, and I've been preparing for it for a long time. But anyway, the Buddhist refuge really has to do with, I guess the word's translated as, by some translators, as a safe and positive direction. Sounds good, doesn't it? But if you're, you know, I always try to think about it in terms of, like, where do you go when the wheels are falling off? Or when you run out of gas, as happened to Robbie today. Or, you know, things are not going well. That's kind of our refuge, isn't it? Nowadays, I mean, I think Buddhist refuge really comes to life when things are not going well. It's nice to have a daily practice where you go for refuge and where you think about it. But when life is not going well, and life is not going to go well How does it end, people?
Death.
That will not be a good time for any of us. It will be a hard time for most people. And unless, I mean, there is a potential, in Buddhism we even talk about it, is how, you know, dying well, in a sense of dying with a peaceful mind, dying, you know, literally, you know, being able to die with a very positive mind, not freaking out. So basically we have to deal with a lot of stuff in our life. So we all have already had to deal with birth, but we don't remember that. Most of us have had a pretty good taste of aging and sickness, and then death is coming. So, and then in between, there's lots of things, right? Lots of issues that we'll all have to come to terms with. Difficult people. Anybody had that today? Yeah, or people you're not particularly fond of. You know, difficult circumstances, you know, where you'll get a diagnosis that you didn't want to hear. Oh my gosh, I've got heart disease, or I've got cancer, or I've got, in a room like this, there's got to be somebody who's got cancer, who's had it, you know, or some relative is dying and got cancer. And so I'm not trying to be negative, I'm just being realistic, isn't it? This is what it means to be a human being. We have a lot of things to deal with. So let's look at what people generally go to refuge for. So what do you, let's talk about it. Rami Ishii used to joke about it. He's a man who started the FPMT. He's kind of he's over here on the left. He was like, Lama Ishii's on the left, the Dalai Lama's in the center, and then Lama Zopa's on the right. Lama Ishii was the good cop, and Lama Zopa was the bad cop. He was like a comedian. He was a great teacher there. He was also very direct, very direct. So he'd say, you know, you people are so, you know, he taught a lot of Western people in the beginning, and you know, he said, right now you got a refuge for coffee, or whatever. You know, but let's look at realistically what we go for refuge for. What kinds of things do you go to? Now, rather than reveal this to the entire room, which I'm sure some of you might not want to do, and this will give you a chance to meet somebody new. Yeah, this would be good. So let's turn to somebody you don't know, introduce yourself, and mention a couple of things. By the way, it doesn't have to be too, you know, intimate here, because a lot of us get a refuge for TV, work, relationships, vacations, sex, drugs, and rock and roll are popular too. But, you know, just introduce yourself for a couple of minutes and then mention one or two things that you tend to go to when the wheels are falling off. Ways that you get some relief, you might say. So let's do that for a couple of minutes. Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay, let's take a break here. I know you'd much rather talk than do this, but let's take a break from the conversation. So I'm going to go over some things that, in a minute, but first of all, I think I got this thing to work. So this is a video that posted in maybe 10 years ago. That's meant to introduce this module, and you can get a sense of it. I'm not sure who the different speakers are. I know Keanu Reeves, or whatever his name is, he introduces it, and so some of the ladies might know him better. And anyway, let's see how it goes. We might need the lights out in the back if this works. If you can't hear it, I'm sorry. Do we have a way to amp? See if you can see this. If you can't see it, it's more important to hear it than to see it. Come around and sit in front if you can't. There's room here. That's as high as I can get it. Oh, that's a great idea.
Satisfaction we're looking for. When you understand you can't find lasting happiness in samsara, then the desire to find true refuge becomes strong. In Buddhism, we take refuge in the three jewels, the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. The Buddha is like the doctor who understands your disease and knows how to treat it. The Dharma, his teachings, is the medicine he prescribes, and the Sangha is the spiritual community that helps you to take the medicine. Take refuge is to finally seek protection from suffering in a way that can really help you. When we think about the ultimate nature of reality and what causes us to suffer, this is the true meaning of refuge.
Before listening to these or any teachings, it's essential to prepare one's heart and mind in the appropriate way, to set one's attitude in the highest intention to be able to benefit all living beings. Now, you're about to listen to teachings on taking refuge in the three jewels, Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. And this motivation, in and of itself, is taking refuge in the path to enlightenment. So in order to gain the most from listening to these teachings, right now, generate in your mind strongly the determination to be able to achieve enlightenment as quickly as possible in order to be of the highest benefit to each and every suffering living being.
We always try to take some kind of refuge, go for refuge, when we notice that we're suffering. And of course, when we were very young, the first refuge we had was our mother. Whenever something went wrong, we went running to our mother. And she was quite a wonderful refuge as a child. Seemed to solve all our problems for us, or most of them. Yeah. But as we grew older, then we found that maybe our mother couldn't solve all our problems, so we discovered or had to find other refuges. And these were our friends, the friends we found, and then we, as we grow older, we look for other refuges, particularly our wealth. We think, we all believe, most of us, most of the time, that money will be able to protect us from suffering and bring happiness. So we find a refuge in money, especially in our society now. This is the main refuge. It used to be religion, some kind of religion. Now it's money or power. We take refuge in drugs, socially accepted drugs like alcohol. These are all types of refuge. We go to them thinking, hoping, believing that they will afford some kind of protection, somehow will bring an end to the suffering. Yeah. Also, food. This is a very popular form of refuge. Sex. Everything we do, actually, is some kind of refuge from suffering, and also at the same time, we hope not only will it stop the suffering, but bring happiness. But we discover with experience that all these different things that we've relied on as some kind of refuge are not a complete refuge. They don't completely solve our problems. They don't bring an end to our suffering completely. And maybe some of us come to the Buddha Dharma because we've discovered that the things we've relied on in the past to overcome our suffering and bring some happiness, not one of them really works. And even all of them together, all of these ordinary forms of refuge, even all of them combined, don't work. They don't really stop our suffering, and especially the causes of our suffering. What we need to take refuge in is something perfect, unbetrayable, pure mind, free of all faults, possessing all qualities. And that is the definition of Buddha mind, enlightened mind. Only that is unbetrayable, something that we can completely rely on and can give every solution. Because one of the good qualities of an enlightened mind is that it is omniscient, knowing everything, so therefore can't make mistakes. So when we recognize that we have suffering and the causes of it, we also recognize that this all arises because of ignorance, the wrong view of self that we have, the wrong view that we have of all, the way all phenomena exist. So this poison in our mind, this afflicted thought of ignorance, is like the worst possible disease that we could have. It's the worst disease because it gives rise to every other disease. The only reason we experience sickness and death is because of karma. And karma is created because of delusions, and delusions depend on the presence of ignorance. If we really recognize that, we have to find someone who is the perfect doctor. And that perfect doctor is the Buddha. Because that Buddha, that perfect doctor of the Buddha, has themselves freed themselves of every disease. They know every disease and the cure for every disease. They've cured themselves of every disease. They know how to cure us. And the medicine, the perfect medicine, is the teachings, the Dharma. And the Arya Sangha, meaning the ordained followers of the Buddha who have practiced intensively and gained a direct insight into the nature of themselves and phenomena, the Sangha are like the nurses who help us take the medicine, tell us when, remind us when to take it, how to take it, in what dosage, and so on. And they inspire us to do so. As an ordinary worldly person, we are always seeking happiness in the external world, out there. And all our suffering and problems, we put the blame on that, on something out there, someone out there. But when we take refuge, or when we do refuge, we become an inner being. We make this conscious recognition that the source of my suffering is not out there, it's in within me. When we first take refuge, that's what we recognize. The moment we start to recognize for ourselves and understand that the real cause of my suffering is not out there, but it's inside, and that the real cause of happiness is not out there, but within me, as soon as we have really understood that at some level, then we have refuge. We become an inner being. We realize that everything, good and bad, is in us, and we have to work from within, cultivating the garden of our mind. When we become an inner being, we become a practitioner of the law of cause and effect. We see that that is the key to everything.
Seek a refuge somewhere. So similarly, in the context of spiritual practice, to protect oneself from the threat of unfortunate or unfavorable rebirth, one needs to seek refuge in the three jewels. So when we speak about taking refuge in the context of Buddhism, we must understand that actually there are different levels of refuge and different types of refuge. For example, the highest form of refuge would be that of a Mahayana practitioner, where the refuge that you are seeking from is a threat of being caught in the extremes of samsaric existence on the one hand and isolated nirvana, solitary nirvana on the other. So to be protected from these two extremes of samsaric existence and peace, you seek the attainment of Buddhahood, that is the embodiment of Dharmakaya, the Buddha body of reality, and Rupakaya, the Buddha body of perfect form. And not only that, but also you seek such an enlightened state for the benefit of all sentient beings. And this kind of going for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha is that of the Mahayana practitioner. And also the refuge that you are seeking from is much more comprehensive. So then we can also recognize a second level of going for refuge, where the protection that is being sought from, the refuge that is being sought from, is the suffering of conditioning, pervasive conditioning, and also the suffering of being caught in cyclic existence, and also your fear of the destructive power of all the negative emotions and thoughts. And in order to seek refuge from that, you go for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, and which embodies the total transcendence of cyclic existence and the sufferings, particularly the suffering of conditioning. And then there is also, again, a third level of taking refuge, where the spiritual aspirant is seeking refuge only from a sort of an immediate threat, which is the threat of being reborn in the lower realms of existence and having a tremendous sense of fear for that possibility, and then seeking refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha to provide protection from that. And here, so when we talk about this kind of refuge, the threat that we are seeking refuge from is the possibility of suffering in the lower realms of existence. So when we think about lower realms of existence, we should not think of a place so far away in the distant future. This is not really the case, because what divides us from the present moment and such a possibility of next life in the lower realms of existence is simply the continuity of this breath that we all inhale and exhale. The moment that ceases, the next life is right there in front of you.
We go for refuge to Sangha, who are the helpers. So the wish to practice Dharma leads to the practice of going for refuge. Yeah? And the first advice, from the Buddhas, when we go for refuge, is to observe our karma. be mindful of our actions, so we don't create negative actions to be born in a lower realm of existence. You know, our mind is the cause of suffering and happiness. It arises out of our mind. So it's much more important to protect our mind than to protect our body. Much more important to protect a positive, you know, state of mind than to protect our possessions, our body, and external things. Yeah? But we have a habit of thinking they are more important than our mind. So we trust our mind and we protect our body. We have to learn how to accept trusting our body to protect our mind. You know? Of course, it's with anger and hatred and aggression that we destroy our happiness. So my purpose is not to harm others. You know, you think my purpose is to practice Dharma, to extend kindness, compassion to others, so that you generate a state of refuge in your mind. Remember, oh yes, ultimate purpose of my life is, you know, to awaken my mind to benefit others. And for this I rely on Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. So we say we need these three jewels. They are jewels, because they help us overcome our problems and put us on a safe and sound direction in life. But the purpose of going for refuge to Buddha, Dharma, Sangha externally is to develop those qualities within ourselves. You can have different meanings of refuge, because there's a kind of inner refuge and there's an outer refuge. When we say we go for refuge, we can also say, I take refuge in my own wisdom. Yeah? But since our wisdom is limited and we need to develop our wisdom, we have to rely on beings with greater wisdom than ourselves. So that's why we rely on Buddha, you know, who teaches perfect wisdom. So we go for refuge to Buddha, that's external refuge, to develop our own inner refuge. You know? And then we go for refuge to Dharma, which is the wisdom itself, in the mind of Buddha. In the mind of Buddha, that perfect wisdom, understanding relative and ultimate truth, understanding the law, cause and effect, you know. And so we go for refuge to that wisdom to gain perfect wisdom ourselves. Yeah? That's the Dharma. And then we go for refuge to Sangha, because Sanghas are the helpers on the path, you know. They say that this state of refuge, you know, generating a state of refuge and compassion, completely stops lower rebirth. It is impossible to take a lower rebirth when your state of mind is focused on refuge and compassion. It blocks. So that's the best state of mind for us ordinary people to die in, to actually be in a state of mind of refuge. Bodhicitta, compassion.
To drugs a good amount for taking refuge, whether smoking pot or whatever various drugs I was doing, or alcohol. the teachings say that it's harmful to do activities like that. And to my mind at the time, that wasn't so appealing, I guess I would say. Like, I just wanted to keep doing that, going out and having fun with my boyfriend and taking drugs or getting drunk or whatever. But more and more I started thinking about the teachings they were giving me, and that taking refuge in external things like that can't bring any kind of lasting happiness. I started to find that not only were the experiences I had on drugs and alcohol not so fun anymore, and were actually more of a suffering experience and brought even more confusion to my mind. I found that the more I took refuge in doing my practices every day and going to teachings instead of to parties and to get drugs and to voluntarily trying to quiet my mind, that the teachings were working and that I was finding more stability inside, more peace, more ability to work better at my job. And I think the coolest thing about refuge, as I've gone on, is that the more I wholeheartedly give myself to refuge and have faith in it, really cool things have started to happen in terms of things that I've always really wanted have actually been able to happen. The kind of people I've wanted to be around show up. Really amazing teachers keep coming into my life. If there's a teaching I've been wanting, it will almost drop into my lap. By and large, I'm a happier person than I was without refuge. And it's my inner experience of having taken refuge that I've seen a change in my mind. I don't even need to check with anybody outside to see if they've seen a change in me or if refuge has made me a better person, because I've experienced it. When people ask me if refuge has made a difference, it's 100% yes, if not more.
Nothing to add. That's really pretty much it. So let's do not everybody's. Well, we have some new meditators and some advanced beginners and all of that. So we probably all are. But anyway, take a moment and let's think about what some of the things you just heard. Sit up straight. And, you can, the main thing is if you're sitting in a chair, you don't want to sit, don't sit back in a chair, sit forward in the chair so that your spinal column is kind of like, you know, little checkers stacked one on top of another, that you're just straight. And, you know, the traditional, I think most people who do in discovering Buddhism have had lots of instructions on how to meditate, but the main thing is a straight spine, because that keeps you alert. And you can close your eyes if you want to, or you can just let a little light in. That always helps you stay more alert. And then your hands go in your lap, the right on top of the left, with the thumbs touching at the navel, the arms a little bit apart, the chin tucked in, tongue resting on the roof of the mouth, that kind of channels saliva down your throat so you're not, you know, swallowing and interrupting your concentration. And just think about things that you heard that may have resonated with your experience for a few minutes. also, we know a couple of things. This is my hypothesis, but I think it'd be hard to disprove this. I think it's the Buddhist hypothesis too, is that everybody that comes to Kadampa Center, no matter whether they're here because, you know, their friend told them to come, or it was, might be, you know, interesting to learn about it or whatever. It could be academic. It could be you have really have significant issues that you want to deal with. But I think everybody here, everybody that comes here wants the same thing. They want to be happy, and we don't want to suffer. And if coming here even one night can give us a little leg up on happiness and how to avoid suffering, that'd be great, wouldn't it? It'd be worth the price of admission, which is free. But it would be nice. And yeah, there's no possibility, zero possibility of turning the mind toward the Buddha or the enlightened beings, the Dharma, or those realizations of those teachings, or the Sangha, the spiritual community that supports. We call them the three jewels of refuge, or the three jewels, Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. Impossible to turn our mind away toward that until we've really discovered what we've sought refuge in and to see the limitations of it. And why would you turn away from money and power and relationships and family and vacations and job and prestige and drugs, sex, and rock and roll? Why would you turn away from that to something is so ethereal? Why would you do that? You wouldn't. As long as you, as long as we believe in our heart of hearts that winning, you know, that having, you know, lots and lots and lots of money and lots and lots and lots of friends and lots and lots and lots of all the delicious things, as long as we believe in our heart of hearts that that's really the most important thing, there's no interest in spiritual practice. There's no interest, I'm going to say virtually no interest in seeking a refuge such as Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, which promises to give us everything our heart desires, like not just happiness, but lasting happiness and satisfaction and peace and even bliss. Even bliss. That's what the claim is. We could have all of that, but we have to turn our back on everything that our culture holds as sacred. And it's not expected to happen overnight, but you think about it, isn't that sort of where we are? Now, a lot of you might be going, well, hey, what's wrong with having money and having a good job and family and relationships and friendships? Absolutely nothing. Absolutely nothing. And in Buddhism, there's no condemnation of any of the things in life that are delicious or desirable. We should have them and have plenty of them. It's not a problem. The problem is we have a mind that is that craves these positive experiences. This is what we seek refuge in. This is what we go for. This is what we're addicted to deliciousness, as one teacher once said. We're addicted to deliciousness. all these great things that our society holds up as being so amazing and worth living and dying for, right? We're addicted to that. And what happens when we crave these delicious things, such as power and money and sex, drugs and rock and roll and, you know, the whole thing, the whole gamut? What happens when we crave something? Is the mind at peace when we're clinging to something, to a concept or a belief in something? Is the mind at peace? No. Mind's not at peace. If we get the opposite, like we crave a relationship, but then our spouse or best friend or boyfriend or girlfriend, they leave us. So we end up losing it. The more we crave or addicted to that person or that relationship, the more we suffer when we lose it, right? The more we crave that money and power when we have it, or if we don't have it, we're not at peace because we want it. When we get it, we're not at peace because we're clinging to it. Like, I can't stand if I lose it. You know, we're clinging so tightly. And then when eventually we lose it, which we will because nothing lasts forever, we suffer even more. So it's not the money, the relationships, the vacations, the fun, the joy, the bliss. It's not that. That's not the problem. It's our mind that's the problem. Our sticky, clingy tendency toward projecting onto all of these things that are delicious, qualities that are way beyond what they could ever deliver. And then we cling to them addictively, sort of habitually. And it creates all the problems. It's just this fundamental ignorance or mistake that the Buddha was trying to point out. Nothing wrong or bad with having great things in your life. Nothing at all. But we sabotage our happiness by having a mind that's out of control. And you may not believe, you know, so the real, Buddhism is an invitation. The Buddhist teachings are an invitation. Check it out. If this doesn't fit your experience, then you're welcome to move on. You know, it's not, you don't have to be a Buddhist. You know, we're not telling people, oh my gosh, you're going to hell if you're not a Buddhist. We're not saying that. But the Buddha said, look, check it out. Come and see for yourself. See if these teachings make sense. See if it fits your experience. If it makes your mind happier. If it doesn't cause you more suffering. If it makes you happier. Why wouldn't you want to at least, you know, begin to do the practices and see if it really is something worth committing to? So there was a mention of three reasons that people might go for refuge. And I'm not going to present these in a traditional way. I'm going to present them in a sort of non-traditional way, but you'll get the sense of it. The first one was fear, or some kind of dread of what would happen with the kind of mind we have. You know, it's having a sincere... You really have to come to grips with your own... We all have to come to grips with how stable and strong and clear our mind is, and how unstable and unclear and wild it is. And I think when we realize that we have absolutely no control over what's going to come into our experience in the next moment. You sit to meditate for 5 minutes. We have no control. Might be able to focus on the breath for a minute, if you're lucky. 5 seconds, really, if you're lucky. But then all of a sudden, all of these thoughts and stuff comes into the mind to distract us, and there's no control. We have very, very little control over our mind from moment to moment. It's just, we're mostly in reaction to the things that are in our senses, the things we see, hear, and touch. We're mostly in reaction to our sensory experiences. And so developing a healthy kind of dread of living with a mind like that, understanding that this cannot go well. This will not end well. You know, that there's something better than this. And that takes time. Just hearing me say it, not enough. The only thing that's going to work, I think, at least for me, a couple of things are going to work. Number one is, you're going to do some practices, and you're going to see your mind shift. And you're going to find yourself, instead of getting angry for a week, you're only angry for 3 days. Or, you know, instead of being, distraught about something that didn't go well, for a month, maybe only a week. You see improvement. You see some improvement in your day-to-day experience of your mind and your life. And that gives you some confidence. But first of all, we have to come to terms with what a mess our mind is, and that there is, and have some faith. Again, this is a hard word in Buddhism. We don't talk about it very much, but it really comes down to this: some basic faith that there is my mind does have the potential to improve. I'm not just stuck with this, whatever's going on. There's actually some room for improvement. And a big part of that is doing the practice and seeing your mind improve. I know that for me, the crucial part of it was actually, meeting the living, breathing exemplars of the teachings. So, for example, meeting Lama Yeshe and meeting Lama Zopa and having an opportunity to hear and see and the Dalai Lama and Geshe Gelug and people like our resident teacher. You see people who've completely dedicated their lives to these teachings and who seem far happier than me. I'm going, wow, I want what he's got. I would like to have that kind of stability and joy and peace and so forth. So that helps to, again, cultivate the confidence. So the first piece of it is dread, right? Use the word, sometimes the word fear gets a bad rap, but we don't drive 80 miles an hour on a 35 because we're afraid we'll get caught. So it's the same thing. We're afraid of the consequences of living with a mind that is out of control. And you go, well, my mind's not out of control. But if you say that, you haven't done any practice. You don't know, you sit in meditation for 30 minutes and watch your mind. Most of us would say, wow, there's a lot of work to be done. And there is. So some kind of honest, fundamental taking account, looking at the reality of our inner world and realizing that there's a lot of work to be done. And that the sources of refuge that we've been going after are essenceless. They're not ever going to deliver what we want. All they can ever do is give us temporary relief. temporary relief. And that is what we call happiness right now. And the Buddhist perspective is much more profound than that. It's lasting, stable, joy, freedom, happiness, bliss. This is the claim of that the Buddha made, if we practice his teachings well. So dread or fear is number one. Then confidence or faith. We talk about what it takes to get there. It's not easy. It's not going to happen unless we, till we have some opportunity to listen and practice the teachings. But we can see examples of the teachings, and that can give us a lot of confidence when we meet, you know, living examples of the teachings, and we think, that's the pudding. The proof is in the pudding, and the pudding is amazing. And then the last one is compassion. And this one's a little bit harder to get. It's like, from a Mahayana Buddhist perspective, the purpose of my life is to help others. Not just to give them food to eat, you know, or a couple of dollars, you know, to the people on the exit ramp. That's nice. What they need. Or what we need, what everyone needs, is to find the causes for lasting happiness and joy and freedom and wisdom and bliss. Wouldn't that be great to be able to give that to people, to facilitate their realization of that for themselves? So, from the Mahayana practitioner perspective, my goal is to guide all living beings throughout all space and time. Sounds pretty big, doesn't it? It's an attitude, though. It's an important, important attitude of a Buddhist saint. It's to have that attitude. It's my personal responsibility to guide everyone throughout all space and time from whatever level of confusion they are that they're at now to supreme happiness. Not just temporary, but ultimate happiness. Yeah, food, clothing, and shelter, really important. But what about, you know, fully developed compassion and wisdom and power and skillful means? You know, things to know what to do to help others. That's what we'd love to be able to be, that kind of person. And so from the Mahayana perspective, we want to help people. And the only way to do that is to get our act together. And the only way to get our act together is to have a method. And the method is to follow the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. They are our guides. The Buddha is the doctor, the Dharma is the medicine, and the Sangha are the skillful nurses. We're not going to get there alone. This is so, you know, so arrogant of us to think that, you know, following the mandate of our ego is going to ever get us any more than the same. We're just going to get the same, you know. As long as we're getting coached by our ego, we're not going to go very far, because whatever we've got up until now is a result of ego's coaching, egocentricity's coaching, self-centeredness's coaching. It's not going to get us very far. So it's kind of like, okay, dread, healthy dread, the kind of dread that's why you don't drink poison, right? Dread, fear of the consequences of continuing to poison ourselves with things that are never going to work. And we got to come to grips with that. And that may take a whole lifetime. It's certainly probably not going to happen tonight. But I'm just introducing the concept. Check it out for yourself. See if what I say or some of the things that I've said make sense. And then confidence that the Buddhas, the Dharma, and the Sangha can guide us. And then we meet teachers and people that are extraordinary and that are so peaceful and happy and joyful. And you go, wow, this is what that path produces. I'd like to have some of that. That's not going to happen tonight either. That's something you're going to have to, we all are going to have to work for. In fact, you know, I've been practicing Buddhism, for a long time. I guess I could say that, honestly. And my refuge gets stronger the more I practice. It's not a, you know, there is a moment when you can participate in a ceremony and say, okay, I commit to being an inner being. The Swami Yeshe said, you know, being a Buddhist is not that big a deal. All we're doing is committing to be an inner being. We committed to be an outer being, seeking refuge in everything out there our whole lives. He said, this is different. This is not that big a deal. We're just shifting the focus to our mind. Now my commitment is to be an inner being. All right? So confidence in the path, the Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, and then compassion for ourselves and other beings becomes a strong motive to take refuge.
Seeking refuge since I started here about a year ago, but I know recently you had a ceremony, and you just touched on that. And I guess I'm in my mind separating, and I don't know if it's appropriate, the practice of seeking refuge versus the ceremony of seeking refuge,
right,
or accepting refuge, however it's put. But I know you had a ceremony recently, and a number of people here did that. And I was all set to do that because I've been practicing this for a year, and I'm okay with the vows, or most of them. but then somebody showed me an article from Mandala Magazine where it kind of went through that, but then it said, this is the point, if you go through the ceremony, this is the point where you say, I am now a Buddhist. And to me, that was incredibly significant. To me, that was like a christening or a baptism or mm-hmm. a confirmation or a bar mitzvah, something of that nature. This is a big deal. And so that's why I didn't go. I thought I'd want to finish this course before I do that. I may find mm-hmm. out something a few months from now that I don't go along with or whatever.
Yeah.
Anyway, will we cover that or can you comment on
those? Yeah, I think it's very good that you didn't take refuge. Seriously, I think that is a very healthy attitude, is that you're in checking it out. You know, you want to make sure it fits. And like I said, you know, with practice, I'll just tell a little bit about my experience. When I first got introduced to Buddhism a long time ago, and I was in Kathmandu, and I went up to this Buddhist monastery, this Tibetan Buddhist monastery called Kapan, and I went up there with my new Nikon camera I picked up in Hong Kong, and I was going to take a bunch of pictures so I could say I went to a Buddhist monastery in Nepal, here are my pictures, And then I met Karen, that lovely Swedish nun who was about 20 years younger and just beautiful, but no hair, wearing robes. And I went, wow, this must be... I met her, and she was talking about this meditation course and blah, blah, blah. And I thought, wow, I could use some mind control. That was my attitude, mind control. I didn't really know what Buddhism was. All I thought it was meditation course. So I signed up for the meditation course. But she said, well, I asked her, do you have to believe in rebirth? Because I'm not sure about that. She said, it wouldn't hurt. It would help. But just, you know, be open. So fast forward, it was a 30-day course. And there were about 200 people there. And most, as one person later on said, asked me, he said, his name is George Chernoff, he's been here as a teacher. He asked me, he said, Don, you are the straightest person here. What are you doing here? Because there's a lot of hippies here and people, you know, into drugs. This is Kathmandu in the late 70s where marijuana was everywhere, and you know, you went into a restaurant, you got high just breathing the secondhand smoke. So I'm joking, that's exaggeration. But anyway, so but fast forward, I stuck it out, and I really did think this could be. I really committed to it about 2 days, 3 or 4 days into it. My seat was, I had bought this giant mattress, and I was about as far away from the teacher as I could get, sitting up against the wall, off the wall. I was in, and I kept falling asleep. I couldn't. So I finally said, I'm going to waste the next month if I don't get up there and find out what he's talking about. So I weaseled my way up to the front row. I was sitting in the aisle. I still remember it. And I started taking notes, and I really gave it. I said, I got to give it 100%. I got to, you know, 100% or nothing. I'm going to find out what this is. And I really listened, and for me, again, everybody has their own experience, but I've heard this from so many other Buddhists that I have to say it. For me, it felt like coming home. It felt like, wow. These are the things that I feel like I've intuited my whole life. But here it is, put in a language that I can understand and arrange systematically in a way that I could actually practice it. And we did the meditations for the month. And I just found my mind had, I had noticed a real shift in, what I don't want to sound too woo-woo here, but not a shift in consciousness, but just a real, I was much more optimistic and hopeful about me and what my future was going to be. And I thought, I cannot. And then they said, they offered this refuge ceremony. And Lama Yeshe was given the ceremony. And I thought, I don't think I want to commit yet. I want to go check these guys out. And so I got interviews with Lama Zopa. I got actually to meet him one-on-one, but Lama Yeshe, everybody wanted to meet him, so it was like six people there. But I really got to see and be up close to them. Because I thought, my attitude was, well, this is a good, nice philosophical system, and it's helped my mind, but I really want to see the proof is in the pudding, right? I want to see if these people really are the real deal. And as far as I could tell from seeing them teach, being in front of people, hearing about other students talk about their qualities, and then actually having a meeting with them, that they were authentically amazing human beings. You know, Lama Zopa, this sounds crazy, but he never lays down. He never lays down. What we would call sleep, he does sitting upright. And he does it, kind of a dream yoga, a type of meditation. So, you know, things like that, you know, completely committed to the welfare, both of them, to the happiness of other people. So I heard these stories, and then I saw them. So finally, at some point, you know, a friend of mine said, just go for it. You know, what do you got to do? I thought, you know, if I leave Nepal and don't make a commitment, I won't do this practice. And I know this has been good for my mind. And so some little boys, I don't know, could have been the voice of ignorance, but now that I look back on it, I don't think it was. I think it was a, it was my guardian angel who said, go ahead and do it. And I can still remember the refuge ceremony. Lama Yeshe said, it's really about being an inner being. He said, it's not that, he kind of played it down. Not that big a deal, not such a, you know, don't make it such a big deal. But it really is about committing to being an inner being rather than trying to find all your answers out there. But look in your own mind and try to solve your problems from there. And so I sat there and I listened, and there are probably maybe, I don't know, 75, could have been 100 people taking refuge with me. And but when he rang that bell and said, okay, you know, this is the ceremony, I can still remember like electricity going through my body, like, okay, now the back door just closed and I'm committed. And that helped me. It's kind of like a marriage ceremony. If you want, now not a lot of people don't think ceremonies are important, but people who go stand in front of 200 of their closest friends, so to speak, but you know, a lot of people in front of, you know, a preacher, and you're making a vow, that empowers the commitment versus making it in front of the justice of the peace, you know? I'm just suggesting it makes a big difference. So so the ceremony is not for Lama Yeshe. It wasn't for him. It was for me to help strengthen my commitment. The thing that I already in my heart of hearts knew I wanted to do. So I was already, in a sense, a Buddhist, but that just kind of like stamped it for me. And honestly, it really felt like I was, because I had a lot of back doors, you know. I still had a lot of fun things I wanted to do. And not only that, my next stop was Rajneesh's ashram in Pune. Now, that could have been fun. But when I got down there, all I did was eat pizza and leave. I never partook of the rest of the good stuff down there. But anyway, by the way, that place was wild. And if you knew, Rajneesh, the guy in Oregon who had all the Rolls Royces and stuff. But so it was good. I mean, it is an internal decision, though. You see what I'm saying? And you're perfectly, it's just like Kadampa Center. The one thing I love about Buddhism is some of the, you know, I've seen thousands of people over the last 25 years coming in and out of here. Some people come, some people stay, some people go. It's perfectly legitimate to leave. If it doesn't resonate with your heart and your mind, it doesn't work for you, then it's okay to go. It really is. But there's another little saying, a couple of things to think about. One is, if you never commit, who's, you know, what's that all about? It's like being in a relationship, you never commit. Like, you've always got a back door, right? So you only get a certain experience. You don't get the full experience without the full commitment. So that's to be, isn't that people's experience? Yeah. You give 100%, if you're 100% committed, you got a 100% chance of getting the full experience. If you're 98% committed, you always got the back door. And you know it. And the other thing is, there's a Zen saying, because a lot of us, I wouldn't say I was a spiritual dilettante, but I kept trying to, I was raised Presbyterian, and I kept trying to find my answers through the Christian tradition, but I just couldn't quite work it out. But anyway, a lot of people, you know, they go over here to this place, and to that place, and to this place, and that spiritual community, and that's all good and well. There's really nothing wrong with that. But there's a Zen saying, he who chases many rabbits catches none. So there's something to be said for finding your spiritual home and then jumping in 100%, seeing where it takes you. But be sure and check it out. If it doesn't feel right, don't do it. If Kadampa Center, if Buddhism isn't right for you, because once you make the commitment, it's just like getting married. Once you make a commitment and then you try to back out, it's very painful, very psychologically damaging to commit to something with you wholeheartedly, and then later on decide, well, I really don't want to do this. That's not healthy. So, I think we've said enough tonight. Is time up?
It's 25.
Oh, good. And yet, one last question. Yeah.
So the first thing is taking refuge in, the phrase you're using is the Buddha, but the Buddha himself doesn't physically exist anymore. So is it more that in any enlightened beings or any beings that have this knowledge?
That is such a good question, because we're going to cover that in the class. But I'll give you the quick answer. There's a historical Buddha, right, that we never got to meet because he lived 2,500 years ago. We have icons, but that's not the Buddha. There's an inner refuge that we talk about. There are teachers, by the way, that many Buddhists think are Buddhas, right? Just like some people think the Dalai Lama is a Buddha, and Lama Zopa is a Buddha, and so-and-so is a Buddha. And we have no way of knowing that. We just are guessing. But really, the inner refuge, and the one that we need to have very strongly kind of in our heart, is taking refuge in our own Buddha potential. Like we have the potential to be Buddha. We have the potential to realize the teachings. We have the potential to become like a source of support and guidance to other beings. So we want to, that's really the deep refuge that we need to cultivate. Along the way, we have outer refuges like enlightened beings, their teachings, and the spiritual community, you know, like that. But ultimately, what we want to do is to get a taste of our own Buddha potential and realize that we have that potential and take refuge in that, and our potential to realize the teachings in our own mind, to transform our mind into the teachings, and then to become a source of inspiration and support for other people so that they can grow. So actually this course is over. We're done. Now, in this little booklet, there's a lot of list in here. By the way, about five years ago, I'm so computer illiterate, but I taught myself PowerPoint, and I made it because there's so many lists in this class. I came up with a PowerPoint presentation, and I just found it tonight. I'm so excited, but I don't have the power. I found it in paper, not in PowerPoint. I looked on my computer. I couldn't find the PowerPoint, but I could put up all these lists and, you know, the six of this and the seven of that and all that, but we'll go over the list. The lists are important to, you know, to know. For example, when you take refuge, generally speaking, you have an opportunity to take the five precepts. So this is, it really is helpful to have some faith in karma, right? What goes around comes around and all that kind of stuff. But the five precepts are said to help protect us. And when I was, this was kind of funny, because when I took refuge in Nepal, Ramayeshi, he's been with us. Again, I was the straightest person there, and I'm serious. Everybody else was, anyway. It was an interesting group. Really nice people and fun people and everything like that. But, I got lost my train of thought here. The precepts, yes. So Lama Yeshe said, see, the five precepts avoid common sense things, really, if you think about it. And I would invite you, or I always try to tell people in this class, these precepts, by the way, are not designed to become, most of us, when we think of rules or rules of ethic, we think, oh, this is just to limit. I can't have fun anymore because all of a sudden now I have these rules. And the precepts are not meant to be like that. They're meant to protect us from our ego, from our uncontrolled mind that's driven by egocentricity. So the five precepts are sort of the things in Buddhist countries that are said to keep society together and somewhat stable. One of them is avoid killing. That's pretty obvious. Stealing. Adultery, which is, there's a lot of ways that's defined, but just basically having sex with somebody else's partner. That's the simplest explanation. So killing, stealing, adultery, lying. And this, what do you think the fifth one is? Not, I don't want to hear any Buddhist, anybody here. So what do you think the fifth one is? Getting loaded. Exactly. Why? Is there anything wrong with getting loaded? Not really. The problem is, this is the problem. When you get loaded, you'll do all the other four ones and not even think about it. That's the problem. So getting intoxicated or loaded is considered to be a problem. So if we can live guided by these five precepts over the next month, just give it a try that on. Just try that on. That would be huge. Even if you didn't meditate at all. I haven't given anybody homework, but this course is online, right? You taught about that. You can do a daily meditation practice if you're courageous enough. You know, I would suggest beginners just set 5 minutes or something like that. And let's just do a, we haven't done much, but we're going to do a dedication. Hello? A dedication. And what you do is just imagine that, for example, talk about karma in Buddhism a lot, and it's really helpful to think that we're constantly planting seeds in our, with actions of our body, speech, and mind. Of course, the mind is the chief one. But tonight, you know, I say that we planted a lot of positive seeds. You know, seeds are going to ripen as the cause of happiness, as happiness and its causes. In fact, that's how we define virtue in Buddhism, is that the long-term consequence of an action is happiness. So, thank you. So so if you get a chance to meditate this week, please do that. The course is online. Give more detail about homework next time.